Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Professor of Sport and Exercise Science at the University of Technology Sydney, Aaron Coutts. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. So in today's episode, I have a guest coming on again that I've been stalking for a long time, but I just want to thank Johan Billsborough for lining this up and putting Aaron in touch with me to get this done. So in this episode, one thing I really was dying to chat to Aaron about was the recent publications that have come out, mainly out of Teesside University in the UK, just questioning the acute-chronic ratio and what Aaron thinks about that and how it could potentially impact how that measure has been used and kind of its longevity. So that's a really interesting kind of 15-20 minute chat with Aaron, which, because the acute-chronic has been so widely used, I think will be applicable to a lot of people who are tuning in to listen to Aaron. So also in this episode, we discuss a lot about mentoring, because there's so many people that I speak to who have come through or been supervised by Aaron, either come through UTS or supervised for an MSc, a PhD, whatever it may be. There's more out there than you probably realise. So that's a really interesting chat. And we also finish off with a little bit of advice from Aaron for young, maybe not even young, researchers and practitioners, and how they should go about their business, really, and how to maximise the exposure that they're getting as a practitioner or researcher to kind of maximise their potential.
The big thing is you get from embedding in sport is you get great context to what all this stuff means and what really works and what doesn't work. So you develop good bullshit detectors. And I think that's critical for anyone who's going to work in sport, that soft skills and the ability to analyse what works and what doesn't work.
But just before we do get into this episode, I want to say a big thanks to Vald Performance for sponsoring this episode today. So if you haven't heard of Vald Performance, they are the guys behind the Nordboard, the Groin Bar, and the all-new Human Track. So if you haven't heard of either of them three products, visit valdperformance.com or follow them on Twitter at @valdperformance. So their all-new Human Track system is a motion capture system which integrates the Xbox Kinect and four IMUs worn on both wrists and both ankles. So Human Track has been initially validated against the gold standard in Vicon with some really positive initial results, with some more to come, which will be openly available via the Vald Performance website when they do become available. So if you are interested in getting to know about any of them three products, visit valdperformance.com or follow them on Twitter at @valdperformance. Also sponsoring this episode today is ForceDex. So big thanks to ForceDex for their continued support of the podcast. And if you are looking for a force plate hardware and software solution, visit forcedex.com. But also have a little look at episode 139 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. So that's at strengthofscience.com/139, where co-owner of ForceDex, Dr. Daniel Cohen, goes into a lot of detail with regards to all aspects of jump monitoring. It's certainly not a sales pitch for ForceDex, but you can get a real understanding of the capability and ease of use of ForceDex with regards to the software. So if you are interested, ForceDex.com is their website, and follow them on Twitter at @ForceDex. So without further ado, over to the chat with Aaron Coutts. Aaron Coutts, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. It's nice to be invited on. It's a great podcast series, and I'm pretty happy to be invited amongst the crew of people you've had on before.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming on and giving up your time, mate. So anyone that doesn't know who you are, just want to give us a little background on yourself, what you're currently doing, different roles, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, fundamentally, I'm an academic. I'm a professor in sport and exercise science at University of Technology in Sydney. And I suppose my work is quite practically based. A lot of my work's embedded in the field. So I have that role as an academic, but beyond that, I have some practitioner roles. I'm a sports science consultant to Colton Football Club, a club in the AFL down here, and have a few advisory roles. But my main job's at the university, which involves research, a little bit of teaching, and a lot of administration at the moment.
So you're pracademic.
Pracademic, yeah, that's a word, sort of a bit practical, mostly academic, but a bit practical. And I suppose that comes from a background of having a farmer as a father. So you have to be practical. You can't definitely be totally academic.
So what was going on before the UTS stuff and obviously all the consultancy? What was the journey?
Yeah. So my background is, like most of us, did a sport and exercise science degree. Originally started off in something totally different, but found my love for sport and thought I might get a job out of it eventually. This was in the early 1990s, ended up doing from my internship in my final year, I embedded with the Brisbane Bears, which were an AFL club at the time, and started to see how we could apply the theory that we were learning in these textbooks at uni at the University of Queensland. I spent a year there, and I was fascinated, and I thought there was a bigger role to play for science. And so I followed that and went on and did a master's degree. I had a supervisor who was very practically minded, and then a PhD. And I suppose in the late 1990s, I embedded my PhD in a football club, in a rugby league club actually, at the sort of one level down from the professional level. And now this is quite common to do the embedded PhD, but the only way I could work in team sport was my passion was to become strength and conditioning coach to get a cohort. So I was a strength and conditioning coach and I had several roles there. If you look at me now, you wouldn't believe that was possible. But, so I spent 10 years as a strength and conditioning coach learning as well as embedding or doing my research alongside that. And that ultimately led to when I got my first job after my PhD down here in Sydney. A coach was at the Parramatta Eels that I'd worked with. He was the head coach at the club I was in, the Queensland Rugby League, and he introduced me to some staff at the Parramatta Eels, and they got me into the Parramatta Eels, and it was my first break in pro sport, I suppose, and this is early 2000s, the similar approach I took in the lower level when embedding research students for a start, try to understand better load, injury, performance, and this is sort of just as that microtechnology tsunami hit us. And I suppose that's the background how I got into the approach. And I was lucky along the way to collaborate and meet with a lot of people that have sort of moulded my way of thinking. And, so that's the background, Rob.
Nice. So you're the RPE guy that people know you for. Where did that journey start? What was the, obviously, given what you just said, that was a tangent from that, but where was the kind of passion for that come from?
Yeah, that was totally accidental. I think Carl Foster, Gunnar Borg's the RPE guy, and Carl Foster is a session RPE guy. I think myself and Franco and Palazzari and a few others have sort of taken that and applied it. So with respect to the guys before us. But, I was doing my PhD. I wanted to do an overtraining in team sport. And at the time, I thought actually team sport athletes overtrained. I don't know how wrong I was at the time, but I needed a way to do a model to team sport athletes. And I remember the exact day I did it. I was in the old days when we used to visit libraries each week before it was all online. I just picked up a book called Running Injuries and found this obscure chapter written by Carl Foster, and it came up with the session RPE method. And I remember sitting down in that actually library and reading. I thought, well, this is exactly what I can use to measure training load, or load at least, in rugby league or team sports. But before then, there was heart rate, and that was uber expensive at the time, totally impractical. And I didn't know how I was going to do my research design. So, and that's how I used that for several years before I actually decided to validate it and put some scientific underpinnings. And it was, from a practical point of view, it was too good to be true. And initially it used to get heavily criticised for its subjective, and actually now is the strength of session RPE. And so that was the late 1990s. I accidentally met Franco Impellizzeri, who's also did a lot of work with, at a conference, science and football conference in Portugal in 2002. And at the time, Franco couldn't speak English. I definitely couldn't speak Italian, but we managed to talk about the research or the work we're doing in Session RPE. Different sides of the globe, it was almost the same. And we decided to collaborate on some of the validation work that's been done. So that's a bit of a background of Session RPE for me. So I accidentally found it, used it for years practically before we actually published anything on it. I know, it, you know, there's people for and against it, but from my point of view, the robustness, when it measured properly, like any tool should be, it's a very good tool of, you know, psychobiological stress. And in my personal opinion, it's probably the most valid global indicator of load. And the best thing about it, it's free, and it doesn't take much more than a little bit of discipline to measure properly. But I do see many people not measuring it properly.
So let's dive into that a little bit. So what do you see people, how do you see people measuring it, and what is the ideal from your point of view?
Yeah, if you follow some of the basic rules of psychometrics or any measuring psychological measures, you know, you should anchor, and I've not seen too many places that anchor football players in particular, you have how, you know, the upper and lower limits, and anchor them against what they should be familiar with and understand the scale and how to use the scale according to the rules of Bohr, which are published. I also see them asking people in front of other people. Many people use non-validated scales, and I might be a bit academic here, but it's just as easy to use a validated scale as a non-validated scale. So I think, you know, asking them, you know, the question properly, phrasing the question, ask them to give the descriptor, then the number. It only takes a couple of seconds to do and a bit of effort and be meticulous in your preparation, and you get really good data. But the problem with it is that I suppose you don't get the good data until you use it for a long time. And that's when the more you have, the more valuable the data becomes.
So when you say a long time, how long is a long time?
Yeah, well, how long's a piece of string is the answer. But, you know, like once you get a lot of data, you can contextualize other responses too, whether that be wellness, performance, injury. Once you start getting enough sample to, you know, and also being able to handle that and visualize that effectively, that's when it becomes quite useful. But early on, it's just a lot of work, and people are worried about annoying athletes. But if you give feedback back to the athletes on how it's useful, some cross-sectional, how it relates to themselves, you get buy-in early. We've been using it now for 15, probably 20 years, and you know, I think it's a very effective tool. The microtechnology alongside that is also very useful, and it's probably made us a little bit brainless. You know, we can just put in a device in a shirt and download it at the end, and that sort of no interaction with an athlete required. So that's a powerful, useful tool, but I still believe in terms of a global load indicator, the Session RPE, nothing can replace that.
So let's talk about where things are going, because like I said to you before, I watched the ECSS talk that you gave for Catapult last year on this, on microtechnology and the kind of journey. Where do you think things are heading? Where's the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years in terms of train load?
Well, I think ultimately everything will be embedded microtechnology. You know, you'll be wearing things that you won't know you're wearing. We'll be able to collect lots of data. But, you know, lots of data is interesting, but it also causes a tsunami. So our skill sets in the future will be handling that data. Data science skills will be important. But, you know, I think even though we've been, you know, a lot of people have been doing this for a long time, the most important thing is having a good system and, and applying a system repetitively. In the future, I think it will be having, you know, greater integration and the ability to combine scores with bigger data numbers, using some of the, you know, machine learning techniques to look at variables of interest. But fundamentally, I think the fundamental tools of, you know, internal load responses, wellness won't go away, but I think we'll have more and more microtechnology will give us a lot more information about the external loads that we're using. In terms of research in this area, though, I think we need to do a lot of work of actually what we're doing, how effective is it, and how much does it actually contribute to a program, and is it all necessary?
So with your academic hat on, with what you just said, so people coming through the system, you would who are interested in this area, be beneficial for them to upskill on that kind of machine learning side of things, so they're one step ahead when this like you say, a tsunami does come and whips us all away?
I think all young or all researchers need to handle data, and but I think that's the amount of data that's coming amongst us that we're now tending to partner with people who do data for a job. Of course, me and my students now, they can handle data, code a lot better than I ever can or will be able to do. So I think they're good skills to have, particularly from a day-to-day data handling point of view. But in terms of research, I think partnering with, there's two ways to go about it. We can upskill a sports science person with data science, which is helps in a translation, or we can partner with data science experts and make it more seamless. So it will depend on the independent situation you're in, but undoubtedly data science is a skill of the future, and it's coming fast.
So are you partnering with sports scientists that have kind of gone down that route right from the start, or separate businesses that kind of specialise in that who are coming in completely kind of raw to sport?
Yeah, done both, actually. So many of the students I have now have fantastic data handling skills, and I've got other people teaching them how to do that and helping us mentor people in that way and students in that way. But we've also partnered as well with big data companies. And companies that handle, from stock market, medical information. And we've got, in some of the clubs I work with, we've got a partnership going off of a big data company. And when you unleash the power there, you can see the real potential and what we can do.
Is that becoming more common in elite sport as well, for them guys to tap into something completely irrelevant, even though it's, data's data?
Yeah, I think it is. And also a lot of them have personal interest in it. The context, the data in sport's a little bit sexy. And so what we found is it's interesting. You get these companies that are working around superannuation funds or financial funds, and they get to work in the context of sport using something they might be interested in the weekend. And we're definitely getting you're getting some high capability individuals working this field. If we can provide the context, the problems, and collaboratively we've had some successes in developing some nice systems.
Nice. So one thing I want to move on to and have a little chat about is acute chronic workload ratios and the kind of swing. Fascinates me, this kind of swing of kind of people going all in and then it kind of potentially coming a little bit of the way. But just want to give us your take on it and maybe a little bit of story like we spoke about beforehand of actually where it's come from and potentially where it's moving towards.
Yeah, I think the acute to chronic ratio, it's a nice rule of thumb. It's a simple sort of heuristic we can use in our day-to-day work. It's definitely made understanding training load and issues around load more obvious to the uninitiated or less initiated. But I think also it's also presents something that coaches have known for a long time, like don't avoid doing too little work, avoid doing too much work, and avoid changing it too quickly. So I think actually it's a nice contribution it's a part of our decision-making process. There's a lot more to be done to unpack it in the detail, but academically it gets a little bit controversial and around some of the issues around decay models or the impact of missing data or the coupling of the numerator and denominator in the calculation. They can read those in the academic papers, but I think the contribution itself has made many of us more aware of the impact of controlling load or monitoring and controlling load. And it's one metric, it's a part of many other metrics you use. But so I think it's a nice practical contribution. But academically, we tend to get caught up in the minutiae. I think we've misinterpreted it as probably being a predictive, and it's definitely not a predictive tool, but it's definitely got some associations with, with some injury. So I think I recommend using it, but I just think being aware and understanding how it's calculated, some of the limitations that it has with it, and also understanding where it comes from. It's a simple application of Eric Bannister's fitness fatigue model, and it's a really nice application of that.
So do you think people have gone too heavy on it and too reliant on it, or do you think they're wise to do it?
It's very difficult to know what others do, but I do know, it's like anything, we jump in deep for a start, we should go step back and just understand and unpack things where they come from. It's a tool and one tool we can use, but it's just as effective and as useful as wellness measures, for example. I think we've got some projects going on at the moment, not necessarily in team sports, but have looked at the contributions to whether any of this monitoring, whether acute or chronic, other monitoring tools are more effective than an expert coach. And we find it does contribute a little bit, but expert coaches also really really good and really bright, and they understand a lot, in particular, performance changes. And this is in endurance sports. We're trying to do some projects as well in team sports. It's, well, what do we actually contribute beyond the expert coach? So in terms of the acute, the chronic, I tend to think, you know, it's a simple, applicable tool. You've got to be careful what you use it with. You know, like we usually only use one metric of load in it, but load has many constructs. So, you know, you can control your total distance and calculate the chronic for that, where your accelerations, for example, might be spiking when your distances aren't. They're, like, it's pretty complex when you get into the minutiae of it.
So I know you said that people can get in the research with regards to the downfalls of it and negatives of it, but just want to give us a bit of a kind of high-level overview of some of the couple of things. I think you mentioned three potential negatives of the acute chronic. Just to give us a high-level overview, people maybe haven't heard of that yet.
Yeah, I suppose so. They're academic arguments, but you know, so it assumes that, you know, the fundamental model presented is that, you know, there's no decay in training load effect, there's no legacy effect, the decay effect of load, and so load further away from the day you do your day you're training has less of effect than the day you've just recently done. And so there's some, you know, the decay models, and you can build those in, and they're available. You know, there's studies being published, and there's discussions about that. There is the limitation of it only, well, it doesn't only, you can do multiple models, but if you use just one input variable, you're only getting an acute to chronic or an indicator of that construct of load or that measure of load. And there's no one single measure of load that predicts anything. I think, you know, you can get different loads from different stimulus from different types of training, and we all do varied training. So you need to be careful about that. If you have missing data at all, that can definitely impact the calculation. So, and I think Martin Bouchard wrote a nice paper in British Journal of Sports Medicine around the impact of that from a practical point of view in soccer. And also the mathematically, I suppose, a coupling of a numerator on a denominator in the calculation. So that the recent week, the acute load, actually is related or correlated to the denominator, the chronic load, and just separating those in the calculation. And there's a paper recently discussing that, I think, from Lolly was the author in British Journal of Sports Medicine. There's some of the basic academic criticisms of it, but I think generally as a contribution, it's a nice contribution as a rule of thumb, but I wouldn't be led blindly by it.
So just before we get into part two with Aaron, I hope you enjoyed part one. Just want to say a big thanks to Black Box Fitness for sponsoring this episode today. So Black Box are a gym company, gym manufacturer based in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and have serviced some of the big clubs in the UK, including Everton Football Club, which is where I came across Greg from Black Box. So all equipment is manufactured in Belfast and distributed throughout Europe and the UK. So if you are interested in any performance equipment for your private gym, for your club's gym, for yourself, make sure you check out Black Box Fitness. So that's blkboxfitness.com. And you can follow them on Twitter at blkboxfitness. And they're doing some really cool stuff on Instagram that I've seen, some really cool images of the kind of manufacturing process, which for some reason I find really entertaining. So have a little look on Instagram as well, because for everyone that's trying to market themselves, everyone that's have a personal brand and all that, you can obviously pick up some tips from Black Box. So doing a really good job. So big thanks to them, and over to part two with Aaron. Here we discuss a bit of mentoring of sports scientists and the kind of conveyor belt that have come through UTS, and hopefully some advice for young academics and researchers. So over to part two with Aaron. Hope you enjoy. So do you think as more research comes available with along the lines of these potential downfalls of it, do you think that'll affect the practical application of it, and people will start to change or move away from it and jump on something else? Or do you think that is there to stay?
Oh, I think it's there to stay to understand the impact. And basically what it's showing us is the impact of change and training load and changing it quickly. And I think that's a good lesson. You don't want to change anything too quickly and because you get a response to that stimulus. So it's a mathematical way of doing that. But I think of understanding that it's not predictive. Maurizio Fancini from Sassuolo and in Italy, we recently published a study with him showing that, whilst there's association between injury and the acute to chronic ratio in a three-season cohort, three-season Serie A soccer players, of the 288 injuries, I think 14 were true positive. So we correctly picked 14 true positive injuries out of 288. So we identified 274 times that there was an injury risk and an injury never happened. So I suppose a practical point of view, don't jump at shadows, just use it as a rule of thumb in guiding decisions on how to manage training rather than being too scared of exceeding any critical threshold. Understand the relative risk of what you're doing.
Cool. So just moving on, keeping on the train load topic, individualizing train load and the importance of that. And it's something that I spoke to Sam Robertson about, 10 episodes ago. But just want to get your take on the importance of that or the practical application of doing that and how doable it actually is.
I think it's extremely doable. You've got constraints. It depends on what sport, of course, but in team sports, we mostly work. I think definitely extremely doable. You have basically a framework that everyone works from, like a weekly schedule, but the monitoring and the feedback we get from load, from wellness, from neuromuscular screening, as an example, all feeds into titrating an individual's training load around the demands of the team, and you just prioritise, which sessions are most important, and you can control the loads individually based on their responses to the training dose on individual level. So I think it's easy to do once you've got your system set up. The difficulty is having the time to set up the system and getting enough time to get the data legacy so you can make good decisions on an individual level. And I think some simple understanding, comparing individuals to themselves over time, the input, so the training load and the response to that, is really simple way you're doing it over the long term is understanding how individuals cope with training, and you can modify that individual level quite easily. I'm not sure that made sense, but so if you have the input dose, you measure the response to the input, and then that wellness screening you adjust on a weekly basis or daily basis, that as well as feedback from clinicians and coaches is also really important in that individual and the players themselves in the individualization, but it's highly achievable even in a team sport.
So is there certain train load measures that are more sensitive to certain players, certain positions than others? And if so, how can you determine which ones are which?
I think it's a simple model and of measuring what you did. If you've got the tools, if you've got micro technology, you measure what you did, your external load, but you also need to measure your internal load, how you responded to that. And that's where I think session RPE comes into that. All of us can do the same session and have a totally different response. And we just do that on a session-by-session basis, and that's the acute response to the training. And then we use the wellness the following day to see the sort of more how they've responded to that and any other stresses in their life, like sleep, fatigue, stress, et cetera. And that might come into decision-making. And we also use medical screening, physiotherapy screening tools, groin squeeze, et cetera, to see how their body's responding to that stressor. And doing that systematically, day by day, you can see the stress response of the players. You can identify non-standard responses quite easily. And all that leads to is a lead generator for a question, a discussion, and a decision made around the players and the coaches and the staff.
Would there be any point in time where you would, say, take RPE, for instance, that a certain person or a certain group of people, you didn't think it was telling you what you thought it should compare to the other measures that you are looking at, so you would remove that from that group? Is there that any time that would happen?
Well, if I was not getting any useful information from any variable, I wouldn't collect it. If it wasn't working for you, there's no use spending time and resource and effort collecting it. Over time, I'd say your compliance of this depends on the organisation, the people you work with. But I've had times we tend to have really, really good compliance. There's been periods over the last 20 years we've had poorer compliance. There's always one or two athletes who give you bad data, but you know who they are. So I wouldn't throw the baby out of the bathwater just because you're getting poor compliance. But I also know there's other cultures, other sporting organisations where this doesn't work. So, you have a hands-off approach to monitoring. We're lucky, I suppose, particularly in Australian football, down in Australia, that they're quite compliant. They get good feedback. We've got great buy-in from the coaches and the organisation, so it works quite well. So there's no one best system. The system's got to fit your culture, your players, and your resources available. There are some fundamentals you get right in terms of doing things systematically, but there's sort of no one system that fits all, that's appropriate for all cultures, sports, and organisations.
Cool. So again, just moving on a little bit to the kind of mentoring sports science side of things. And just speaking to a couple of people about chatting to you today, the amount of people that have did my Viva was working there, or I'm going to work there in one case. There's obviously a lot of people around the world that have come through the UTS system and obviously been working under you. But what's the importance of putting, like you said right at the start, of embedding the PhD students in clubs and how it sets them up to then go do their own thing in America or in the UK or stay there in Australia? How important is that to have that system set up?
Well, I think first of all, it's brutally difficult to get employment at the high level in sport. So you need to be highly skilled, and you need to not just have good egghead skills or data skills, scientific skills. You also need to have the good soft skills. And I think that by embedding in sport, you develop that pretty quickly. You learn how to cope and communicate. The soft skills come out. So I think the big thing is you get from embedding in sport is you get great context to what all this stuff means and what really works and what doesn't work. So you develop good bullshit detectors. And I think that's critical for anyone who's going to work in sport, that soft skills and the ability to analyse what works and what doesn't work. I've been lucky enough, I suppose, or we have to partner with many organisations, and a lot of people have come through here have gone on to work in other places, and that's probably the most rewarding part of my job is seeing that. It's pretty cool to see guys come through here and or wherever, but go on and work in sport and have an influence at that level, either in Australia or elsewhere. The big thing is, I suppose, getting good people in for a start, and that usually comes from having internally motivated people, soft skills, the ability to work in a team. And those who focus more on the process rather than the outcome of it all. Sounds a bit cliche, I suppose, but they're pretty important characteristics. You've got to be able to work in a team and work together, and particularly in a sporting environment that's high pressure. The other thing, I suppose, is understanding the performance pressures, and you pretty quickly learn what's nice versus necessary. If we can put research projects around that and develop research skills around that, I think that prepares people quite well for working in the field at a later time.
Has it become more popular for like the recruitment side of things? You're getting a bunch more applications than you used to, or is it still as popular as ever?
Yeah. I'll get a lot of people. We get a lot of inquiries, but I'm sure every university around the world gets a lot of inquiries. Particularly, I get a lot of people who inquire who are interested in working in sport. But there's only a finite amount of positions available. There's only so many organisations that you can work with that have got the ability to take to do this. There's several stakeholders in doing this. It's the organisation, the clubs themselves, the ability, I suppose, for us to show benefit of embedding research and what legacy of embedding research in organisation is. And if you stay there long enough, it's definitely quite easy to make a case of how you can have legacy of systems or increased knowledge you can improve your professional practice or understand performance better. So you need to have good stakeholder buy-in. And particularly early on when we first started doing this, they were pretty suspect of what these eggheads were going to do and help us win football games or play any better. But, we've had a lot of people have gone through now that I think we're developing a track record that it's sustainable at least.
Mm-hmm. So I had a chat with Martin Bashai a couple of episodes ago about the amount of emails that he gets about working at the club where he is and things like that. But with the popularity of applied PhDs, what advice would you give to people applying for them? What are the skills necessary beforehand to kind of put themselves at the top of the pile rather than sinking down to the bottom?
Yeah, well, I think there's several things, but I think the soft skills coming those in an application, like I rarely take people that you don't know or don't come highly regarded and recommended by people you trust, because to go into an organisation, there's a high level of trust there. So you're developing networks. I used to joke about the 10,000 hours. There's a terrible thing about our field, the 10,000-hour internship before you get an opportunity. We've got to do something about this. But, yeah, but you've got to be well prepared, understand sport, but also understand it's science as well. It's not just sport. It's science, and have good scientific knowledge. It's not surprising that Martin gets a lot of applications because he has all those things. And have people that like working in teams is most important for me. It's a pretty flat structure where we work, and you've got to don't mind rolling your sleeves up, doing the dirty work for a start until you sort of get the opportunity. But soft skills are the big ones for me.
Great. So just moving on to the kind of future research for you guys and the guys that you're working with, what does that look like? Which direction are you going? What's the future hold?
Yeah, I suppose most of the questions that we come up with, we steal from people in the field. You see the problems that are occurring there and try to solve their problems. Some things that I'm interested in personally is understanding what is performance in team sports. Team sports, it's not GPS, it's a lot more complicated than that. It's not just technical. It's not just tactical. It's all a part of those. And what are coaches looking at when they're measuring performance? And if we can get a good measure of performance, then we can understand how every other thing relates to that. And they say we're all about performance. Other things I'm interested in is actually assessing the value of our work. So actually, what difference does our work make of the monitoring that we do? Is it all necessary, useful? Is it nice or necessary? And understanding how we can directly contribute to improving performance or the process. We're getting into a little bit of qualitative work. We're doing a lot more work asking athletes and coaches their thoughts about things that we're doing rather than just doing them. Probably should have done that for a long time. And other areas more academically, I suppose, is around looking to improve methodologies in our studies. There's two parts. There's field-based studies that are done small sample size case studies, and there's other parts of work where we've got to do with multi-centre studies, good data before we can have good inferences. And there's this big spectrum from applied sport to controlled lab studies. And I think we can take some learnings from controlled lab studies to apply even in some of the applied field studies as well, so improving our methodology. And then the last one that probably, I don't know if I can do, but I'm definitely getting help with, is getting better handle of different statistical modelling approaches to handle our sort of structures of the data we have and the massive amount of data that we do have. So there's some areas that we're getting into, see how they go in a few years' time, but the things that interest me.
I think for me, the assessing the value of the work that sports scientists and do would be absolutely fascinating. Definitely, it's something that I've spoken about a lot on here with various different people. I think that'd be really interesting for me.
Yeah, are we just in job creation, or do we do jobs that actually make things better? I'm quite certain that we do, but it would be good to have a value of our contribution to either performance, to a value of injury prevention, or even the knowledge legacy, how that improves what we do in professional practice. So that's some of the areas of interest for myself anyway. I'm sure others are working in similar areas. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the fact that it's so hard to evaluate that is one of the reasons why, especially here in the UK, that the job market is so difficult with so many and people get sacked left, right and centre because they're associated with manager, and that's pretty politics on the inside. But where it's so hard to quantify whether this person has done a good job or not from administration.
Yeah, absolutely. And if administration, and I'm doing some of this work with administration of clubs, because they make significant investments. Every staff member is a pretty reasonably large fixed cost. But if you can show return on effort, you can show, you know, return on investment, you can you know, definitely justify positions. You'd hope eventually, I know it probably depends on the sport and the culture, but organisations will set up frameworks, support frameworks around organisations independent of managers. So you've got continuity, data legacy, systems legacy. Historically, you see so much that, you know, people change and you lose all that data legacy and systems legacy that, and you start over again. And that's obviously got to be a massive loss of, massive loss of value for the organisation. So I'm sure management would be interested in this as well.
Cool. So one very last thing that I want to ask you is something that I've asked every guest for the last probably couple of months, and that's the two most influential books. Doesn't have to be kind of sports science or something conditioning or whatever. It can just be anything that's kind of influenced you throughout your career or of late or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose the biggest influence recently for reading my bedtime reading for my kids. I only have a four-year-old daughter and 8-year-old boy, but that one's probably not for here. Two books that I've enjoyed reading recently. I didn't mind reading The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis, and that was a follow-up from the Thinking Fast and Slow from Kahneman. And look, Kahneman was a heavy read, The Thinking Fast and Slow, but this was a more of a story around the partnership I enjoyed of, you know, successful partnerships between Tversky and Kahneman and their career. I really enjoyed reading about that. So that was a good read. And I've just finished reading an excellent book by Alex Hutchinson called Endure, and that's around the limits of human performance. And so that I've just finished reading that this week. So that's a real recency one, but it's an excellent book if you have time to read. And I suppose I've read a few sort of leadership management books as well, Simon Sinek stuff. Interesting and easy to read.
Superb. Excellent. So what book's up next? What book's up next? Have you finished Endure? Is that done? What's up next?
Finished Endure. I've got the Culture Code on order, so I'll see how that goes. And I've probably got, something about Spot the Dog tonight in about an hour's time for my daughter.
The best of all. How will it end up?
Yeah, mate.
But...
always ends up well for the
good. That's most important. So anyone that wants to know or get a little bit more info on you or your research or, you know, social media stuff, where can they find you?
I suppose the only social media I really use is Twitter a little bit, so I think it's Aaron J. Coots. My email, I suppose, contact me by email. I'm intermittently good at responding to emails depending on workload. I think, as Martin mentioned in his late recent interview with you, yes, I did get his book chapter done for those who heard him have a dig at me. Aaron.coots@uts.edu.au is my work email.
Brilliant. Well, Aaron, thank you very much for giving me time. Really, really appreciate it. And enjoy Spot the Dog tonight. Hope he turns out all right. And we'll chat soon.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks for inviting me on.
No worries, mate. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Hope you enjoyed the chat with Aaron. So finally, massive thanks to Aaron for giving up his time and bearing with me while I stalked him for the last 2 years to try and get him onto the podcast. So thank you very much to Aaron for taking the time. So massive thanks to the three sponsors of the podcast today, Vald Performance, Forstex, and Black Box Fitness. So you can check them out at valperformance.com, forstex.com, and blkboxfitness.com, respectively. So some really interesting guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. Again, make sure you press subscribe on your chosen podcast player, and I will speak to you in the next episode.